Hey there, you're listening to episode 23 of The Flyover Effect. This is Scott, and we're doing things a little differently this week. Myself, Dan, Neil, and our friend Jeremy Harrington from Voce Communications sat down to talk about the legacy of Steve Jobs. We recorded this episode on Friday, October 7th, in case you're listening far out in the future, and the world learned this week that Steve had passed on. So we thought it would be interesting and a humble tribute to talk about our first Apple experiences. Enjoy the show.
It was first grade, Apple II, playing Oregon Trail, and this awesome rock mining game, but I don't remember the name of it.
So this is Jeremy. Mine really starts at college, freshman year of school, before school even started, walking and literally having a two-wheeler to move the hardware, which was, a 7100 Mac in the mid-90s. Took a two-wheeler across campus to get the hardware into my room, and being one of the only people around that had it, you had the option then to buy either a PC or a Mac, and for whatever reason, that was the route that I went. And from there, worked in a lab on campus. At the time, I was a musician and been asked to teach Finale software, which, if you're familiar with, was music notation software. So I walk into this lab. In the mid-90s, they were the New Media Center. It was a consortium of labs that Adobe and Apple had worked together to put into schools, Yale and a variety. I think there were about 8 or 9 schools at the time. And Kirksville, Truman State, had one of these. It was a big investment. It was a lot of software, a lot of machines. And there was this music section, and there were some nice synthesizers and stuff. And I ended up, that's where I wanted a job there. Got the job to teach the music software. Nobody ever came in to learn about music software. Nobody. You had, you know, nonlinear editing. You had all Photoshop and Illustrator and all these great stuff. And Dreamweaver was just starting, and you've got all these Macromedia products. Macromedia boned up and gave all a bunch of stuff, just like Apple did. But nobody wanted to learn about the music side. So I was filling in and helping, and literally spent 60 hours a week or more in there, on and off the clock, with a variety of folks. And some of those folks have gone on to do really great professional things in design and other stuff. And but really came from that. And the money and sort of effort that Apple gave to that group and all the machines and everything, but also support, was really pretty cool. And so I can honestly say I've never owned a PC, never had one in my home that I've owned. Whenever I've had one for testing, it's always been borrowed and sort of given back. And I think there's quite a few folks now, but for the longest time, that certainly wasn't an honor to say that. A lot of people sort of look down on that, but I can proudly and honestly say that's the world that I live in. So hopefully that means something to my kids.
All right, so my story is a while ago when I was still in college, I was really interested in spam filtering. Like, I had a lot of spam and there wasn't any really good tools to deal with it. I had been using a bunch of weird, hard to configure stuff. Back in the day, we had a giant 18-foot satellite dish. Like, that's how we got all of our TV. And we were able to point it to a channel that had the keynote streaming, like, over a satellite. So I watched the keynote during the summer in my time in college, or maybe at the beginning of the year. And they announced spam filtering built into their mail client. And it was the first time, Apple keeps doing this. It was the first time that someone had taken this very hard to configure new technology and made it very, very accessible, very, very easy. Like, that's something that everyone says Apple does well now. And that's what really got me hooked on it. And so, by coincidence of me being able to watch the keynote on satellite, by coincidence of me knowing a developer, a Mac developer that lived or visited town every single year, I was able to get a beta of that next version of the operating system. I bought a used PowerBook G3, which is still one of the best computers of all time. Was able to put the beta on it and try it out, and I loved it, and I've been using a Mac ever since. So just the thing that Apple's known for now is the thing that got me hooked on it to begin with, which I think is very neat.
It's kind of like Gandalf coming to town to visit the hobbits like once a year, and he's got his caravan full of fireworks.
Yep. My entry into the modern Apple world is actually... That's where mine is, kind of interesting. Is it's because I was working at the Virtual Reality Application Center, and since high school, I've been way into Linux and doing all the Unix stuff and being a system administrator, and that all was very interesting. And then when I got to college, I'm working at the Virtual Reality Application Center, and I'm supporting all the Linux laptops or Linux workstations in the lab. Other than the my part was the Linux part, and then our big systems administrator, he did all the big iron because we still had SGI at the time. And I had a Dell laptop that I would install every new version of Red Hat and Fedora on. And after a while, just things like the networking, or, you know, Wi-Fi would stop working with every patch of the kernel. And I'm like, desktop computing is fine in Linux, but why is this laptop and portable stuff so hard? Why can I just not put up my computer and connect to the internet just without trouble? And so I got a 12-inch PowerBook G4, and it had a Unix prompt, and I was in love from then on, because every time I could just turn on my computer, it never didn't connect the internet. And I was just off and rolling, doing work instead of working to get my computer to let me work.
I think it's really interesting, too, when you look now, the number of developers, particularly for the web, not, you know, taking iOS maybe and some of the other things out, but you look at web developers, if you're at a web development conference, not just design, but, you know, development, whether that's, PHP or whatever, the number of Macs that you see. And fundamentally, thinking of these as a consumer device or centered around making things simple, things like the spam and these other things, the process to get there, to make these things simple, has the double effect of making it appealing to the guys who want to do the really hardcore stuff and build things with it and do all this. And I never imagined that there'd be a time where you could look out in these crowds and see virtually no PCs in certain conferences. Almost every front-end sort of web conference that I go to, where you see people, you know, working in CSS and JavaScript and that sort of area in between, almost entirely Macs. And when you start to look at, you know, you browse through and see the photos from those, and so much of that is Mac focused from the developer side. It's a pretty big accomplishment to think about satisfying the demands of that group in a way that makes sense, whether it's through flexibility or power or whatever, but then also satisfying the demands of grandma and grandpa and everybody else. And getting it right is getting it right for all of those folks, which I think is just interesting.
So my first computer at all was an Apple II series, and I don't remember exactly which one it was, but they'd been out for quite a while. A couple of little programs on it. I think there was a typing tutor, some sort of some kind of Math Blasters style educational game, and it had, I think it was Claris, but some sort of word processing program. And there was like little clip art things that you could drop in there. And it was really, I don't know, it was really fun. It was really empowering. Like I'm pretty sure I sat on the floor with it, you know, just like little kid typing away at this thing. And it was, I talked about this on Facebook a little bit, and people seemed to respond to it. I felt very creatively empowered by it. Like I was always kind of a creative kid, but I didn't paint, I didn't draw that much. Like that wasn't stuff that I did. I liked stories, and so I had this little word processing computer and just kind of went to town on it, and had a lot of fun with it. And then the next computer we got was some 386 DOS based something or other, and it was really exciting because it felt a lot more open, you know, like I felt kind of empowered by that too. And I hadn't really pieced it together until I think just this week in looking back retrospectively, that like all that time spent on PCs and fussing with stuff and dialing into things, like it was interesting, but it wasn't creating anything, you know. It was learning, it was definitely tinkering, and it was very instructional, but I didn't make things with it. And that's kind of been the difference for me. And I'm recording this podcast now on a MacBook Air. This is the first Mac I've ever purchased for myself, and I got it after my experience with the iPhone, because the thing just worked, you know. And it's I've felt very creatively empowered by my iPhone. Even I've started using Instagram and just, you know, publishing more updates, and I use it to journal. Like I finally started keeping a journal because I have a great little app for it that pops up on my phone. So I guess that's what I like about Apple stuff, is that it, because it's so simple, because you don't feel like you have to do anything with it, you can just kind of sit down and get to work.
For me, it kind of taught me to not chase versions, to not care about megahertz and, you know, like coming from the Linux world, like you've got an update. Oh my God, you know, PHP 4.2.2.2 just got released. I can do apt-get update and boom, like I've got the brand newest PHP. But that's not create, you know, like you said, it's not creating, that's not doing me any good. And, you know, all of a sudden now something's broke and you know, coming from the developer world, you're either chasing all the brand new software so you can say like, oh, look, I just use this brand new library that came out and it works great 9 out of 10 times and its build system sucks because it just came out. And, you know, there's so much finagling instead of just working. Coming from working with Apple since like 2002, it kind of just drains on you. And after a while, you're just like, I'm done. I just want to do stuff. I don't want to care anymore. I want to go buy a computer and go home and do work instead of go buy a computer and tinker. And, oh, look, I overclocked my, you know, processor and I got 0.2 extra megahertz out of it, which I can run, you know, SETI at home better now. And who cares?
You know, I'm very proud. Like, I have a PC at home and I built it myself and got it all set up. And I'm proud of it and it's fun. But I understand, too, that there's an element of hobby to it. And I don't think some people realize that the work they're doing in building, configuring these machines, like the computer becomes this little trophy case, you know, of like, oh, well, I got all of these components to work together and I've been able to, you know, I'm running the latest version of this and this and this weren't designed to work together, but I got it to work together. It's like, okay, cool. Now what have you made with it? Oh, you know, I just play games on it and stuff.
Yeah. When was the last time you cared about IRQs when it came to Mac? And yeah, everyone's laughing now. But I mean, that was your that was the trophy. Like, this IRQ and this IRQ are conflicting, and I went into the into the BIOS with my big old sword, and I conquered them.
In the creative piece of that, I mean, that from the days that I started using ResEdit and editing icons, because that's really what kind of got me started in a lot of this from that side of things. And it's, you know, that being open and accessible enough to be able to get in there and make those changes. And again, those were creative changes that sort of led on to other things. But that door was always open. And that's one of the things, I think it's just from the creative side of this, the door by and large has always been open to get in there. So if you are a tinkerer and want to do things, you have that opportunity. But you have that opportunity on a variety of levels, you know.
I think like switching from PC to Mac, the biggest thing for me is that it taught me to embrace constraints. Like, not necessarily on the operating system level. Like, I can still tinker with the terminal and do a bunch of nerdy things. But it really, like Dan talking about version upgrades, like the iPhone is such a good example of embracing constraints. Like, they have a cycle where they want to get rid of things and they give you a couple years to do it. But by doing so, they're saying, well, these are the constraints you have. These are the new constraints you have. You need to support these old phones. You need to use the best features from the new phones. And they really make you think about the structure in which you do things. They really set boundaries and then challenge you to use the boundaries as best as you can to do what you need to do. You're not always, with PHP or whatever, upgrading to the latest and greatest to get that little thing that you just are sure that you need. Browser development is very similar. You have to be able to get things to work with what you have. And not sit around complaining about how you wish things were. It's a very practical view of the world. Like, this is how things are. Get used to it. Do the best you can with those constraints.
The community makes it very different, too. That's been the most interesting thing to me, I guess, just having... I mean, I went all through high school, all through college, several years working independently, and then just now I've had my Mac for less than a year. And... I guess what's been most interesting to me is all of the little software packages, the little tools, the little tweaks, the little fixes that the independent developers have put out there. The quality of those, the attention to detail of those is just staggering. I mean, they're just these little hobby projects where someone will, you know, they prefer Windows to behave this way instead of this way, and they write a little program for it. But the way it installs, the way it runs, the resources it uses... is just fantastic. And I'm trying to imagine like any Windows tool at all that I ever came across that didn't just feel kind of like this junky, ugly patch that someone put together. And I think that speaks to, it's a very positive cycle. Like the kind of people who are attracted to the platform are also the kind of people who make that kind of stuff. And it's very cool.
Did you guys read the article about the guy that was talking about his inner Steve? He had heard a rumor that Steve Jobs might be using his program. And he's talking about this feeling that he needed to make his program, his software, or his app as good as possible on the off chance that Steve Jobs might be using it on a regular basis. And I think that that's something that the Mac community has, is we know that there might be someone that we really respect in the Mac community, in Apple as a company, that might be using our products. And it's that drive to program for that inner Steve that really can make a lot of difference.
And that independent developer community, the indie developers, I mean, absolutely had to be critical in Apple's decision at all to when the iOS is sort of coming around to say, we would open this up to have people, you know, bring apps into this device. And it's a handheld device, and here's all the things we're going to do. But that's only possible in a sort of ecosystem that had as many independent, thoughtful, you know, well-done independent sort of Mac developers as there were. I mean, there's this huge community for decades that has been out there. And that have, you know, made the leap, you know, to OS X and made the leap to the platform changes that have happened and the constraints that Neil talked about and what they had access to and all of that have stuck with that to get them to a point that there's even something there today where you have the opportunity for applications on a device like that. And it really does all go back to the independent developers, not the big, you know, the big boys of software development that make that possible.
So one other random memory I have too, and even when I was growing up with PCs, I'd stay at my grandmother's house a lot, and she was a media specialist at a public school, and so she had to kind of stay up on Macs and Mac software, and she had a little Mac. I don't remember what it was, but there was some sort of print shop program with an old dot matrix printer that you could print banners on, and just spend hours. Like that's what we did at grandma's house. She had a box of Lincoln Logs. She had a copy of Wayne's World on VHS, and she had this printer and this print shop program. And we would just make banner after banner, just goofy stuff. And there, if you go through like the family scrapbook, there's probably every my cousins. I have two cousins that are about my same age, and every birthday party there's some sort of homemade, Apple program designed banner hanging up. And it's just interesting. I had never, you know, like, to be perfectly honest, when I heard the news, I certainly felt it was tragic, but I didn't think I didn't know if I cared that much. Like, you know, I hadn't grown up idolizing Steve Jobs. I hadn't grown up a Mac person, but just the more I looked back and the more I reflected on all the stuff I've used and the way, those programs had interacted with my life is pretty powerful.
There is a sentimentality, I think, that comes with that. And again, the connection of these things, I think it just speaks even more to the fact that how much a part of us these little pieces have become, whether it's the personal computer side all the way to today, where I think the piece that strikes me the most is seeing my kids, you know, interacting with the phone and an iPad. In you know, there's going to be those memories when you look back, and having touched that and shaped that. And it really is thinking about watching a Pixar movie on an iPad, going through this experience and really understanding that it takes a special kind of culture to do that. And the cultures at that level require a force to sort of push them forward and to make that something that's a true culture that can push those elements together to make the scale of things happen. So the fact that people are touched by this in a huge variety of ways just speaks to what that was, which is this was a cultural shift that started by saying people can have access to this computing ability starting from this wooden box that we built all the way through, and the impact and the influence that has, you know, all the way to today. And for me, you know, really on the sappy side of things, seeing my kids do that is the piece that sort of threw me over the edge to say, this really is a big deal. You know, I mean, regardless of how much I enjoyed Macs and doing all this stuff, there is an honest to God impact today in my life with kids learning and doing stuff. And everything else aside, that's pretty profound and means something.
The idea that there are people that are around that are producing this stuff, that are thought leaders, that are like, you read some of Steve Jobs' quotes. Like, some of the things that he says, like, I'm bummed that he's not going to say anything new. I think that's what matters to a lot of people is this idea that you just felt better about the world knowing that there was someone that was yelling at people because the button didn't click properly. Like, I want there to be more people like that. And that's what really bums me out.
I'm sad that I can't have those conversations with myself anymore when I find something, you know, in the Mac or on the iPhone where you're like, how did this get by Steve? You know, like, these guys went rogue on Steve and he didn't see this. They must have put this in afterwards. And that kind of bums me out that, you know, because I have those inner monologues all the time about different software. And, you know, did the guy who built this, did he actually see that? And did he use it every day? Was it staring him in the face and he left it like that? Because that's what I thought was one of Steve's more powerful contributions.
Yeah, like there's this idea that Steve Jobs looks at every single thing that Apple has ever built, like the screws in the laptops and the text in the alerts that pop up. And like that's why Steve Jobs is so ingrained, because there's this feeling that he's touched every single thing that they've ever worked on.
And you can find a lot of stories where especially with the design community that I interact with and the folks that I know that have worked there and have been inside those walls and going through those anecdotes, and I've tried to favorite as many of those as I can on Twitter as they've come by so other people can see them. But, you know, one of the ones I read yesterday, you know, talking about the iTunes icon, and I think it was Louis Mancia from Icon Factory, and now he's at Apple and some stuff, but talking about the email reply where the blue wasn't beautiful enough in the new icon for iTunes. That they're just, that story multiplied times a thousand, times a thousand, times a thousand, makes it almost mythical, right? Like, how can somebody be that involved with this level of detail? It's comforting to know, you know, it's like somebody standing on the watchtower, right? It's the watchtower of stuff that's good versus things that are crap. Yeah. And he was kind of, you know, a watchman out there, keeping the crap out. You know?
I mean, and as far as like watchmen go, it wasn't necessarily about the blue. He just knew that as humans, we could do better. Like, that was a good try at that icon, but you can do better. Here's why.
And then it means something, right? That icon means something. It's not just tacked on to the end, right? That experience starts well beyond you ever launched that machine. But once you're in the thick of it, that means something. I mean, that there's import in that.
You know? Well, I think that's a lot of the people that don't get Steve Jobs. I think that they don't believe that everything means something. There are people that dislike the idea of entertainment. There are people that dislike the idea of fun. Like saying, oh, it doesn't matter. Like, there are starving kids in Africa. Like, of course it matters. Who we are as people is shaped by everything that we do. Like, everything matters. That button matters. Like, that alert dialogue matters. And if you don't believe that, then you're probably not going to get what Steve Jobs has been doing.
I think it's an encouraging sign for our culture, just how much of an impact he had and how people are reacting to the news. Because if you think about it, like, you know, if a, I don't know, William Shatner's getting up there, right? So if you know, the day William Shatner dies, there's going to be a lot of retrospectives. There's going to be a lot of very sad people. There's going to be a lot of very depressed Trekkies. And it's, to me, doesn't seem, I don't think anyone would consider that an abnormal reaction, you know, and I'm not going to give too much voice or credence to the dissenters, but there's a general sentiment out there from a lot of folks that people are making too big of a deal out of him or his life. And, you know, To me, it's fantastic. It's wonderful that we can idolize and be inspired by someone who's focused on a fairly unique discipline of, you know, design, industrial design, user experience, and to have just to show that our culture can be a little bigger, that it's not like just sports and Hollywood. You know, Apple's kind of, their products, if, you know, people are way more excited about what the 4S than they are about some new blockbuster film that's coming out. And that's a little bit of a cultural shift that I think is very encouraging.
The whole story of Steve Jobs, I really enjoy. I mean, one of the most interesting things for me, especially in context of where we are at today, is the idea of how a lot of the success that he had as a CEO is probably because of 10 years of exile from the company that he helped start. I think nowadays we seem to let CEOs run companies into the ground and then give them a $14 million severance package. And I think it's really interesting, the idea that you have to fail a little bit to be successful. Like, that part of his life is really interesting and people forget it. Like, Steve Jobs failed. Like, he started a company and he hired someone, and that he tried to get that person fired and he ended up getting kicked out. Like, he was fired, he was gone for 10 years. And only then did he start this new phase of the company that has been so incredible.
I think that return to that 1996-97 era is probably one of the most interesting pieces, and I'm sure in the books that come out and other things are really, you know, I'm sure there's drama in there, but thinking about walking into that building again after being gone, and how am I going to get this army of people back online with a vision that he's held from the beginning, right? Something he's known and a path that he's been following, that he had, you know, he's away from it, he's coming back. Just what it speaks to, again, the organization, the culture, whatever you want to call it, but also as an individual to be able to walk in there and make the changes and do what was done there, is just really incredible. So if you want to be, you know, look at it from a business or a leadership perspective and take everything else out of it, you've got one heck of a case study to be spending your time digging in. If you're out there just absolutely looking for a reason on why you should care, you know, there's a good place to start, because this, what had to have happened to make that work and bring that ship back up, has to just be an incredible story.